This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Masserol. Are you ready to discover your True North Story? Everybody out around the world, gotta tell you what I just heard. There's gonna be a party all over the world. I got a message on the radio, but where it came from I don't really know. And I heard these voices calling all over the world. All over the world. Everybody got the word. Everybody at the world is gonna be tonight.
Jeff Lizowitz is our guest on True North Story.
Hey.
We are so glad that you are here. We have been having a great time just getting to know you a little bit. You are an author. You are a professor. You are a creative. You are a screenwriter.
Friend of Richard Walter.
We are so glad that Richard's team told us that we needed to talk to you.
That's right. Yay, Kathy.
Exactly.
Thank you, Kathy.
Yeah. Hey, Richard, and you guys.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. So let's just kind of dive into Little Jeff for a minute. Okay. Grew up where, what was early life like for you?
Some might say I've never grown up, but that's a whole other story. I was raised in Pennsylvania, Reading, Pennsylvania. You guys ever been out there?
John's family.
Well, my whole family is from Meadville area.
Oh, okay.
Erie, northwest corner.
So we're in the southeast corner.
And it's a big state. I know that much from driving.
Drive down that turnpike. You got that, exactly. Right? So, Reading, Pennsylvania, our claim to fame there is a pagoda. It's like one of three Japanese pagodas in the country.
Wow.
Sitting on top of the hill overlooking the city.
Are you the sister city with some place in Japan?
No, there's some strange story about how this pagoda got there.
I'm
going to probably screw this up, but back during, I think during Prohibition, some rich guy said, oh, I'm going to make a hotel out of this pagoda. You know, I'm going to build a pagoda, put a hotel in there, bought the land, built this thing. It's sitting up there. And then he's ready to go. And he forgot one thing. He didn't get a permit from the city.
Really?
Oh, oops. And the city's like, no, you can't have a hotel up there. So he's like, oh, geez. And I believe, if the story's right, he gave it to the city as a park.
So wow.
It's a park, and it's been there for, 100 years.
Wow.
It's an expensive park.
Yeah.
It is. But it's
for him, but it's...
but cool for everybody else.
Yeah, exactly.
You grew up knowing that you were a creative being, or how did that go for you?
How did I know, or when did I know I was a creative being? Well, I think I was one before I knew I was one.
Uh-huh.
Which may be true of a lot of people.
Oh, for sure.
I remember as a little kid just getting sort of lost in interior worlds. You know, my mom would be like, go out and play with the ball or whatever. And I'd be building cities in my mind and that kind of stuff. Another huge piece of this, which I didn't realize at the time, was my grandfather gave me, when I was maybe 8 years old, a little plastic camera. It was a real camera. It wasn't a disposable camera, but it was a kid version of a camera. And I started taking pictures. Turns out my grandfather had a dark room in his basement. So he taught me how to develop film. And to, if you guys have ever done that, when you see those images,
they just appear.
It's freaking magic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm taking a picture of my mom and I'm taking a picture, my brothers or whatever. And just seeing it come up there was just like amazing. So I got into that. And, I've been doing photography now my whole life, too, which sort of turned into filmmaking.
Right.
Screenwriting and creative writing in college. I have a degree, much to the chagrin of my parents, creative writing with perspectives from philosophy, religion, and psychology.
Holy cow.
Oh, my poor dad's like, oh, God, what is this kid doing?
Yeah.
So now I'm doing podcasts.
We were going to ask you, because Tam and I always talk about this. This is kind of a recurring theme with some of our guests that are creative. Kind of the impact that the parents, or the influence the parents had, your parents had, in either saying, hey, you know what, Jeff, pursue that creative bent, or no, CPA looks good, doctor looks good, let's something a little more stable.
So I got a little bit of both, actually a little bit of one and a lot more of the other. the supportive part was, They did buy me a guitar, so I learned to play guitar with, you know, a guitar they bought. It was basically a Kmart special, you know,
right, just right. Like the was it acoustic, right? I'm sure.
Well, or, the whole story.
Okay.
Right. I started out with an acoustic guitar that we had laying around the house, and it was a piece of junk, basically. And we got a teacher, this is maybe in fifth grade, we got a teacher who was trying to teach me to read off the paper, you know, read the notes, and he was like this old guy, and I was just like, oh, God, and I can't do it. I'm not interested. So quit that after a couple months. By the time I was about 14, I was turning into a, you know, slight delinquent type. And, you know, my parents were like, you got to get a hobby. Get a hobby. You know, I'm like, a hobby? I don't know. Well, I was getting into music. You know, I loved music. I'm like, I want to play guitar, but I want to play electric guitar, and I want to pick my teacher. And they're like, okay. So they got me this, you know, Kmart guitar.
Okay.
And I found this long-haired rocker guy.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. And I go into that first lesson with that guy, and I'm like, hey, man, I want to rock.
Right.
Right? I want to rock. I don't want to learn music theory. I don't want to do all this, which I'm not necessarily saying this is a great idea, but this is where I was at.
At 14.
At 14.
Right.
But this
from someone who teaches music now.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. But I would go in with these different songs. I'd come in with a Bowie song and a Tom Petty song and a, dare I say this on the air, a Quiet Riot song.
Wow.
This guy would figure it out, teach me how to play it. And then I'd go home and play it for, like, you know, 100 hours until the next week. And I just did that for, like, 3 years until I knew how to play guitar. So that was the supportive part.
I bet your parents were the ones banging their head after that one.
They were. Very good, man.
But it took me a second. Mama says that I never, never mind her. Got no brains. I'm insane. The teacher says that I'm one.
They also got me a 4-track tape recorder. So,
oh, wow, cool.
I know we've got all kinds of amazing gear here.
Yeah.
But back in the 80s, you know, when I was in high school, the 4-track tape recorder was that cassette recorder. I mean, you could do a multi-track recording, but it sucked, but you could do it.
Right.
So I spent another 1,000 hours in the basement recording my songs with this piece of shit drum machine, this basically piece of shit recorder. I'd go down there, I'd play my songs. But the classic was, in the evenings, my mom would do the laundry. So I'd be playing this, you know, playing the song, and I'd sort of strum out, and the chord would ring out.
Yeah.
And then it would go down, then in the background, you'd hear, gung, gung. Gung, gung. So I've got like this whole series of songs with like, you know, the dryer.
They're like, what is that? Is that?
That's the Maytag.
Yeah, that's the Maytag on that.
Do they add that in studio afterwards?
Exactly.
That's pretty funky.
That's
how do
Mom
we replicate?
On the Maytag.
Yeah, be like, how do we replicate that? I really dig that, you know?
Exactly. So yes, they were supportive in a lot of ways. And in other ways, they were like a lot of parents are who have, you know, creative kids. Get a job, like do this as a hobby, which was a big, you know, huge
right.
part of it. So it was definitely like, go for something smart, go for something with health insurance, go for something, all that kind of stuff. And man, I had to fight against that internally up into my early 30s.
Really?
Oh yeah, because I always sort of felt guilty about making music or doing whatever I was doing. It kind of turned around, well, it did turn around, when I started making money from it. I got into music for film and TV, and it took forever to get there. It was my, like I said, mid-30s maybe or something like that, but suddenly these checks were coming in from making music. My God. And then, you know, call the parents. Hey, guess what? My song's on MTV's Real World. Like, are you kidding me? My song was just
doesn't
on
doesn't get
MTV.
Any better than that. Yeah.
How did that come about for you?
That placement?
Yeah.
Well, that was my first placement ever. The way that came about was in college, I had a friend who was in a band, and he somehow got music on MTV's Real World. And I remember him talking about it and telling me. So this was years later, 5 or 6 years later or something, and I was getting into this. And I'm like, well, I guess I'll send them my music. So I made a CD. This is back in the days of CDs. And you send it to their production company. I called them. You guys get it? Yeah. You listen to it yet? No. I'm like, okay, cool. Call them back the next month. You guys listen to it yet? No. You guys listen to it yet? The next month? No. Literally for a year, I called MTV.
Every month for a year.
Every month for a year.
Wow.
Finally, on the last time, they said, you know what? we actually did just listen to it, and it's great. And we want to put it on TV like in 2 weeks. You've got to be kidding me. So they send me the paperwork, sign the deal. The deal was, by the way, for all you musicians out there, the deal was we want to put your music on, but we're not paying you anything.
What?
Jeez, seriously? And the reason is because there's so much music and I wasn't famous.
Right.
So there was nothing really for them to pay you. Like,
there's no leverage.
There's no leverage, right?
You know, you had no leverage.
Right. So fortunately for me, I knew enough about the business that I said, okay, I still want to do this. I'll sign your paper. Go do it. I did have my songs registered with ASCAP. Okay, ASCAP is a performance royalty organization which pays royalties based on performance. Like on the radio, every time a song gets played, the songwriters and publisher gets paid. It's actually a lot more on TV, depending on a bunch of different factors. So the song goes on. I'm sitting there with my buddies watching this thing. I'm like, oh my God, I'm on MTV.
Which Real World was it? Do you remember?
Las Vegas.
Okay.
Which was good because that was a really popular season.
They
played it a million times.
Yeah.
And I kept, that was that. It was done. I was happy, you know, whatever. And then it was over. 9 months later, I go to the mailbox. There's a check for $1,500. Are you kidding me? That's amazing. That's more money than I made from every gig I ever played combined. Right. And then the next month, there was another check for $1,500. I was like, oh my God. And at that moment,
you're hooked. You're like, I don't get the next
I like money coming in the mail. Yeah. So then I realized, hey, I don't need a band. I don't need to play these gigs, although I love doing it. If I'm going to do this as a career, how about I do it? I do this music placement. This was in the late 90s. Right. So that was before everybody had GarageBand on their computer.
Right.
And the market wasn't flooded with tons and tons of stuff. But I had the foresight to buy this primitive equipment, digital recording equipment. And since I had spent like a zillion hours on that 4-track, I could pretty easily port it up so that I could now record at home for free at a quality that was, you know, broadcast level. So I just sat there for years and made hundreds of songs and then got involved with various different companies who helped place the songs. And before you
know, what is that like now, Jeff? I mean, because you bring up a great point. And I don't want to discourage anyone.
Right.
But at the same time, there are professional musicians and then there are people who are not professional musicians,
sure,
but think they are.
Right.
And so how do you cut through the clutter, the noise, you know, if you were wanting to do the same thing you did in the 90s today?
First, I'll talk about like my sort of philosophy around the whole thing. And you sort of touched on it. It is amazing the tools that we all have now for so cheap to create films, to, you know, photography, music, all this kind of stuff. So what a huge, amazing blessing this is really for everybody, that instead of a crappy 4-track, it just comes with your Mac.
right? Exactly.
And you can actually do something. So you still need the skills to do it, right? But at least you have the tools to do it. So I am a big proponent of anybody with a creative spark to do something, and that's of course, you know, sort of what my whole book and my whole trip is. Then you have the other side, which is the business, right? So what this creates in every creative industry, and really lots of other industries too, is oversaturation of noise. There's just too much stuff, and most of it isn't that good. So what do you do with that? Well, if you're going to be serious about your music or your screenwriting career or film career or photography or anything, you have to be smarter and innovative and differentiate. You know, it's all basic business stuff. Just putting your song out on iTunes or Spotify is not going to work. I guarantee you.
Right.
It's not going to work.
No.
Right? Because you're in there with literally, what, tens of millions of other songs. Nobody's going to find you. So then you've got to be like, okay, now I made the music. What's up with the business? And then you've got to study, learn it, have a mentor, try different things, do whatever you can, and really think in ways that are not typical for musicians, right? Musicians generally don't think of their career as a business. Like,
it's a very creative, passionate, emotional thing to create music. Business, in a lot of ways, is the opposite of that. It's very cold, it's very calculating, it's very black and white, it's rational. You don't think about that. You're like, okay, now I've poured my heart out. Now what do I do?
Right.
Well, you got to approach this like a business person.
Exactly.
You know,
what's your plan?
Yeah.
Where's your profit coming from? How can you find different income streams from what you're doing? And what do you really want to do? And what are you really trying
to do? And I wanted to ask you this too, Jeff, because I think a lot of people are saying, well, there's more opportunity than ever before to get into the entertainment business, whether it be screenwriting or music making or whatever. But I feel like that technology has also increased the barriers more. Like, instead of opening them up, like, it's also allowed the big companies and the big record companies to lock down even more and make it more difficult. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know if they lock it down. I mean, they do in certain ways. I mean,
right.
I'm sure some of these companies are paying for spots on playlists.
Right.
Right, which is essentially payola.
Yes.
Right, except
for
that
sure.
It's not illegal yet or something. I don't even know where that's at. You know, it's a different thing. Big companies generally have power because they have money and connections. The biggest thing they've got.
Yeah.
They're not innovative. Right?
No.
If the music business was innovative, they would have seen Napster and said, oh my God, yeah. This is the best thing ever. Yeah. Instead, they freaked out and ran away and nearly got killed. So yes, they do have... You know, they do have the money and they do have the experience, but what they don't have is the flexibility and thinking, right? And that's why the small guy always has some advantage, right? So maybe you don't have a huge budget, right? You can't outspend
Warner Brothers.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's not going to happen. But what you do have is the ability as a band or as a solo artist to just make decisions and take action. And even if you have $100 to put into it, if it's a smart $100, maybe you can turn that into 500, and suddenly you just made a 500%. Warner Brothers is not making 500%.
No.
I guarantee you that.
No.
You know.
No. That's why they're doing the tent poles that we always talk about.
Right.
You know, it's the biggest bang for their buck. But as a screenwriter myself, we were talking about Richard and all of that. Tam and I are looking for new shows. There are things out there that are good.
And then there's a lot that's not.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's the bell curve. It's just like everything. So much in this world of skills and media and all this, it's mediocre. It's okay. It's passable. It's whatever. Some of it, 10%, 5% on the one side is just like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
What is this? And then the other 5% is like, wow, this is truth and beauty and actual art, and it connects with whatever the audience is. It's just the way it works.
Okay, so we've got you selling your music for television, and...
I want my MTV.
Hey, me too.
We're all from the same wheelhouse.
Yes.
Yeah.
What sparked your interest in other ways? You were writing, you were reviewing music.
Right, I did a lot of that. Okay, music, I think different art forms, a sort of primary way that they connect. So music, I believe, is primarily emotional. Just like we said, if there's a song that really has the right lyrics, really the performers are really feeling it, you feel that.
Yeah,
whether it's
sure.
love or anger or rebellion or whatever the thing is, you get that on an emotional level. But other art forms are different. So a film, although it certainly can be and should be emotionally resonant, it also includes ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get a big idea out of a little song, although sometimes you can. But in a film, you've got an hour and a half to develop an idea through the characters and the plot and the theme and all that kind of stuff. So I was fascinated by that. And then you say, like, okay, well, there are limitations also to film. So in writing anything from a blog post to a book, you can now do things that you can't do on film. Because on film, as Richard Walter would say, you better be able to see it or hear it. Because that's all there is.
Yeah.
You write a novel or a short story or something, and suddenly you can get inside the head, inside the thoughts of the character, and that's like a whole other deal. So there's that kind of beauty. Then you've got a photograph. So I love photography for a million different reasons. You know, anything from capturing a snapshot to creating beautiful fashion shot or just a beautiful image, a portrait, whatever. And that also can evoke emotion. It can also evoke an idea, but it's essentially just beautiful, or whatever you're going for. Photograph certainly doesn't have to be beautiful.
Yeah.
It could be nasty or provocative,
Sure.
A news shot of the Vietnamese war thing with the monk lighting himself on fire. It's like, that's not real beautiful, but man.
Wow, it's powerful.
It's powerful.
Yeah.
And it tells a story and it has emotion all within one piece.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to watch that for an hour and a half.
Right.
You don't even have to listen to a song for 3 minutes. You look at that picture and you're like, damn. Right?
3 seconds.
So I think the bottom line on all these things for me is, how do you communicate? So much of what we're trying to do as humans is just communicate. It's to be seen and be heard and understand each other. And it's so fucking hard.
Learn, love, listen, live. True North Story. And now, back to the program.
Tell us a little bit about the book, No Effing Around. Where did this come from? And talk to us a little bit about that.
Not Effing Around, the no bullshit guide for getting your creative dreams off the ground. My latest baby. So where did this come from? As we've been talking about, I've been a creative type all my life. Mm-hmm. So I've got all that going on and all this, these experiences with all these industries and thoughts and all this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, I've also been this empowerment type. As a younger person, I was a summer camp counselor, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know, getting all these kids going. I now like a songwriting teacher, like we said. I've practiced something called NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Repatterning, which is a counseling modality that helps people untangle their subconscious blocks to sort of have bigger, better lives, be more conscious, make better choices, etc. And I've studied as a life coach, right? So I'm a life coach. So that's on the other side. So one day, a couple years ago, I was minding my own business. Went to a coffee shop on a Saturday morning, as, you know, many of us do, chugging my coffee. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to do some writing. Maybe I'll work on a screenplay, poem, journal, whatever, you know, as I often do. So I start writing something. It's sort of in this realm of not effing around, or NFA, as I like to call it, NFA. Right? I didn't know why I was doing it. I didn't know what I was doing, as usual.
Right.
But I did it. And I was like, you know what? This actually melds both my passion for being a creative and empowering others. So I was like,
it's a perfect combination.
It's a perfect combination. I just write this book. Why not? You know, what else am I going to do?
Right? Right.
So I wrote the book. And after it was done, I realized that this is actually like my mission to be creative. And I still am, of course, and I'm doing all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And also to empower others, because it is, as Richard says, it takes an incredible amount of courage to do this stuff. Any screenwriter, writer, poet, filmmaker,
anybody,
photographer, anything, yep. You are going to get shot down and dissed, and the haters are going to come out, and people are going to tell you can't do it.
You suck.
You straight up, you suck.
Yeah, exactly.
And on and on and on and on and on, even as you get successful, right? Yeah. Maybe even more so in some cases. So, you know, like this is something that has meant a lot to me through my trip. Whenever someone would actually take the time to read my stuff and give me some feedback, and like, hey, that's not bad, or this could be better.
Right.
Or come out to my gig. Like, I can't tell you how much it means for one freaking person.
This is amazing, Jeff, because we have a practical application to this, right? And you are so right. Sam and I are shopping a television concept mm-hmm. that I've written that I feel very, obviously, very passionate and connected to. And so we've been shopping it around, and we had an opportunity to submit it to a high-level executive at Amazon on their original content side of the house for television. It came from somebody who was a very good friend of ours who had this connection, and she kind of put herself out for us. And he said, okay, you know, have him send me an email with, you know, the bullet points, and looked at the stuff. And then he said, well, you know, let me think about what blah, 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 blah. You'll need to sign a release, and then you can send it to us. And then we didn't hear back. And then like a week went by, and this is not unusual. I'll get to the point of why I'm bringing it up. And then he came back and he said, no, I'm not interested. But that touches on exactly what you're talking about just wanting someone to read it. You know what I mean? It's not even like green lighting it and going, oh, this is amazing, or let's have a phone call. Or it's just giving you the respect to look at your work critically and say, I spent an hour to read this screenplay or this pilot. They won't even do that.
Oh, yeah. It's huge.
But that's why the empowerment part, to your point, is so necessary.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of anybody who does anything like we were talking about before. You know, my students at school. They write their first song. Of course, it's kind of going to suck, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I am cheerleading all the way
because
at the beginning of the semester, they had never written a song. And now they wrote a song. And that's huge, right? For anybody. Another piece of this book, which isn't quite as overt, according to the title, is that creativity, although we all want it to be seen and, you know, maybe get big hits and get rich and all that kind of stuff, that's great. But another huge piece, and probably the bigger piece of it, is that creativity helps us both be healed and expressed and seen in the world. In the world, there are so many people running around and we feel anonymous, right? In a lot of ways. You walk down the street in Seattle in the middle of the day and there's hundreds of people walking by, right? Who are you? What you go online and it's the same thing. It's just like endless. When you create something, you sort of externalize a piece of yourself and give it to the world in a way that can be known. So that is a huge piece. Another thing is this healing bit. So there's a lot of ways to be healed in the world, right? So perhaps you get your therapy, maybe you meditate, maybe you exercise, maybe you talk to your friend. All that kind of stuff is great and fantastic. But with any kind of creative endeavor, you take what's inside of you, you step it out, you almost play it out in a certain way. So in one of my screenplays, for instance, it's called Panacea's Dream. And it's about a shaman and a scientist who invent this pill that is a magic cure-all. It's a panacea. It makes anything, any illness disappear.
Wow.
It works. Cool, right?
Can I take
it? Yeah, you can, sure. I got some in the car. Thematically, what this is about is the interplay and the duality between science and faith or spirituality, right? So this is a huge part of me. Like, I've got this huge sense of spirituality and connectedness and magic and metaphysics in the world, right? And then on the other hand, I'm like, well, kind of prove it. Like, give me something. And this is a part of me that's, it's been there forever. In writing this screenplay, I can play it out within these different characters, right? These characters are always a part of us in some way. So creativity externalizes ourselves and gives us a chance to give it to the world. Like, I believe that creativity is actually an act of service. It may not seem that way because it's always, it seems so hard to get your stuff out there.
Right.
But what you're really doing is offering a piece of your truth, whatever that is, in whatever way you can, to the world. And that is like the key to the whole freaking world.
Put a piece of yourself, your truth out there.
Yeah.
How healing is that? If we could all do that in some beautiful way and appreciate each other's gift.
Absolutely. And it doesn't, although it's great to have a hit movie or a giant stadium filled with screaming fans or something, it is also extremely powerful to put that blog post up or your ebook, sell 20 copies or give away 20 copies or even write that poem and give it to your friend or your lover. Or, send it to your mom.
Yeah.
That's big.
That's going to be how we, as a society, evolve and be like, Jeff did this, or there's aspects of Jeff's story that really connected with me on a personal level, and I'm going to pursue similar things. It's just really powerful.
What was the process, Jeff, of getting your book written? I mean, it's easy to say, I sat down in a coffee shop and I wrote a book. And
the audience is going, I sit there, I can't even get one letter.
I got writer's block I haven't even started.
Well, first, I
got
to tell you guys, it's only 9,000 words and there's a lot of cartoons in it. Right? So it's not, it's not a 30,000 word job. This book for me was really different than really any other creative project that I've ever done because I didn't really have to think that much about it. It really flowed out of me because everything I write about in there is stuff that I've experienced or thought about basically my whole adult life. All I had to do was kind of organize, like, what do I really want to talk about? And then write about it. And then, fix it up and revise it a million times and stuff like that.
But rewrites.
But unlike, creating a screenplay where you're like, okay, so these are the characters and how do these scenes have to work and like all those kinds of things. This was just like, what am I trying to say? How do I say it? Say it. It really was not that difficult for me to write it. What has been a challenge is, like we talked about earlier, the business part.
Yes.
Okay, so great. I have this book. Cool. That's cool. Here it is. Now I want to be of service. I want to get it into people's hands with my workshops, my webinars, all that stuff. How do you do that? Just like putting your songs on iTunes, it's not going to work just sitting there on Amazon.
Right? Yeah.
It just will not. So what do you have to do? This is when you click over into the business mind. You say, okay, let's read about this. Let's study this. Let's think about this. Let's make a business plan, right? If you're really going to do this, it's a business. Like, it turns from being a writer to being a publisher, which is really different.
Now you go around and you give talks about this whole idea of making your creative self foray into whatever it is that you want to accomplish, want to be. Have you been heard? And what's the feedback been?
I've been doing workshops around town, around Seattle, and that's going great. I am about to start an online workshop series. So I'm really happy about that because, as you know, the internet can take you from Seattle to the world. And I've got lots of people, you know, who seem to be commenting and all this kind of stuff. Feedback is generally really good. I think it's simply because I come at this just with truth of this. Like, I'm not selling something that doesn't matter. I'm not selling just some widget. This is what I believe in. This is what I live and breathe. And I feel like it's my mission.
To empower people.
Well, and that, and that crosses over the line. You know, when you feel it, when it's something you're passionate about and you're truly engaged in it, it takes on an authenticity that isn't there if it, otherwise.
Absolutely.
And people sense that.
Yes.
So they know Jeff is not only just involved in this, Jeff is living this, Jeff is breathing this, this is part of who Jeff is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't just influence people anymore. You know, you got to have this because your neighbor has it. And if you don't have it, you're less than your neighbor.
Right.
It's got to be about something bigger. And
exactly. So a couple years ago, I turned on to a guy called Simon Sinek. Oh my gosh. So he's got, so anybody out there in podcast land, do yourself a favor and watch this TED
Please.
Talk. Please. Simon Sinek. It's called Start With Why. And he's talking about marketing, but it really is about everything. He essentially says in marketing messages, almost everybody does is say the what. Here's what we do. Okay. Sometimes
we sell cars.
sell cars. Sometimes they say how we do it. And very seldom do people say why they do it. However, we are, as humans, hardwired to want to know why. So my great example on this is, okay, you're going to find a new dentist, right? And you interview the first dentist and, hey, how'd you get into being a dentist? Well, you know, my dad was a dentist and I was always pretty good at science and I figured I'd make $250,000 a year. So yeah, I became a dentist. You're like, okay, all right. You talk to the next one. So why'd you become a dentist? Well, when I was a kid, I fell off the jungle gym and smashed my front teeth into a bloody heap. And I went to a dentist who really took care of me and got me through this really traumatic time and got my face back, you know, a beautiful smile now. So I was like, you know, I think I ought to become a dentist. Which of those two are you going to pick?
The latter.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because there's truth and heart and like something real behind
it. A passion that they have for their craft.
Yeah, they want to help others.
Well, and to your point, Jeff, so many people, like, you ask them, you know, well, why do you want to do this? Or why do you want to become this? Or why do you want to write that? Or why do you want, you know, and it's like, well, I don't know. I guess I just thought it'd be a good idea. You know, it's like really, really articulate. And that, to your point, it changes. It's a game changer.
It is a game changer. And that is a huge part of my workshops and online stuff, simply understanding, because people just don't tend to go inside and ask themselves the questions that they need to ask to get deeper and deeper and deeper into who they really are, because we're so distracted by all the freaking cell phones and everything else.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Right? Sit there, you know, by yourself and, or journal and write these things or, you know, these kinds of questions. One of the worksheets and sort of modules we do is called Our Gifts and Perspectives. So it's a bunch of questions and discussions around what is your gift and what is your perspective? Because guess what? You have one.
Oh, sure.
Everybody has one. That doesn't mean you are tapped into it. It doesn't mean you understand it or can express it. But if you can do that, if you can answer those questions honestly, you will tap into that. And once you can do that, then you can find the core that drives you, because something is driving all of us.
This is True North Story. Learn, love, listen, live. And now, back to the program.
Do you want to torture?
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned something that just resonated with me about being alone. And I think as a society, you know, I'm not sure how that, whether people are comfortable being alone, you know, like, I mean, just with yourself and your thoughts to do whatever it is you want, whether it's to write a song or to make a video or to write a poem or, to read a book.
Or to sit there and look out the window.
Yeah.
So last December, I decided I was going to have a staycation.
Oh.
Ooh, right?
Yeah.
For December, for a couple weeks in December. So, you know, I was like no work, no nothing. I'm just going to sleep late and exercise and watch movies and lay around and hang out with my friends. Like, just totally.
That sounds like heaven.
Yeah.
Right. It was. But here's the thing. First morning, slept late, woke up. I'm like, okay, I'm walking across the street. I'm going to get a coffee. Okay, cool. Got the coffee. Came back. And this is like, there is nothing on the agenda for the day. Nothing. And I just sip that coffee and look out the window. And it was bliss.
It's magical.
I can't even describe what it was to not have to do something. Where suddenly you're just being. And we so seldom get even a freaking hour in a week to just sit there and be. And it was literally like ecstatic. And I was sitting there by myself, drinking a coffee, looking out the window.
I subscribe to your point of view wholeheartedly. I because my dad was older school and my family members, and you know, where it's about, well, how productive were you today? Well, you know, what did you do? Okay. So you work 45 hours this week. That's great. What are you doing? Are you trying to find a second job? Are you, you know, what's going on? You know, I don't think you're working enough. I am not measured as an individual by my job. You know what I mean? Some people are, and that's okay, and that's fine. But, you know, at some point, there's more. And I think maybe that's the creative part, too, is that we're constantly looking for more, not only ways for more for ourselves, but I mean, more ways to give that out into the universe, too.
Mm-hmm.
But by the things we create,
absolutely.
You know, I am with you. I will. And I'm working with my co-host here, Tamara, to get her to spend a little more time with herself and just the things that she wants to do and just unwinding to that bliss that you're talking about. Spend it with a book. Spend it staring out the window. Spend it in the bath with a glass of wine. Do what you know, whatever. Because I think the more people do that, the healthier they are.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely. Mentally, yeah. Emotionally, physically, all of it.
So by the end of the 2 weeks, were you climbing the walls?
No.
Okay. I'm just checking. I don't know at what point you go, I better just check my emails once.
But I'll tell you what, when it was, so this was close to actually 3 weeks. At 2 weeks, I was not climbing the walls. At 3 weeks, I was also not climbing the walls, but, and I really felt like I could go another week. But I was also super revved up to go kick some ass.
Yeah. Recharged.
It was such a recharge. You know, the weekend maybe is a recharge, hopefully, for people, but
it's not long enough.
It's not long enough. And, you know, it's only a day or two, you know, taking a couple weeks. And, you know, even a vacation, like, hey, a vacation's great, but a vacation is really, in a lot of ways, kind of stressful.
It can be.
So here's another thing with that staycation that really struck me. I did not realize how exhausted I really was. After a day or two, I was just like literally laying there watching movies for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And it was great. Suddenly, you know, all this tension from the last year or two or five or whatever.
Or 20.
Just kind of dissipated. I was like, okay,
yeah.
I don't have to be running around. I mean, obviously we have to work and all this kind of stuff, but to take that time for yourself, it was like an honor to myself, because we're always, you know, doing things for others, for our jobs, for our families, friends, whatever. And that's great too, right? That's fantastic. But to take some of that time to
and not feel guilty about it.
Fuck that.
This is a little Jeff time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
People have said you need to be a little selfish sometimes.
Absolutely.
You need to be a little selfish. What does selfish mean to you?
Yeah. It's not selfish, I think, in the common context. People are like, oh, you know, that guy's selfish, you know, whatever. Yeah. But that's not what it really means. It means that, you know, you honor yourself. To, you know, it can go too far and like, you won't share,
right?
Or whatever, you know, something like that. But, you know, essentially, it's okay to be selfish. It's okay to say, no, I'm not going to your party because I really don't want to go to your party like, it's just not, I'm too tired. I had this, and this was actually a sort of huge thing for me. Over the summer, a friend of mine who I haven't seen for quite a while, 10 years or something, you know, back from Pennsylvania, was coming up to visit. Was only going to be here for 2 days. Guy took forever to kind of get in touch and make the plan. Finally, at the last minute, he made the plan. And I was so tired that day. Normally, years ago, I would have just dragged my ass out there and been like, okay, and it would have sucked and whatever. I said, you know what? No.
I'm drawing the line in the sand.
I'd love to see you, but I can't do it. Wow. And was that selfish? Sure. Was it the right thing to do for me at the time? Absolutely. If he took it the wrong way, well, too bad, you know. You know, another piece is with a selfish thing, you're not responsible for how somebody else reacts. If you say something, if you say no with kindness and truth and they get all pissy, fuck them.
Exactly. No, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. You know, it's interesting because I think we're living in a time right now where people are, they react like you were saying, as opposed to controlling. The control is with you. If somebody says you're dumb, how you react to that, you know you're not dumb. Right. So it's like, well, you're ugly.
That's a great way to get it going. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So yeah. I want to switch it up just some interesting stuff. Sure. So tell us a little bit, who are some of your, because you've been in writing and you, obviously we talked Richard Walter. What are some of, let's just have fun. What are some of your favorite movies or some of your favorite bands or, you know?
Yeah, let's start with movies. Why not?
Start with movies, huh?
Or some of your favorite screenwriters or directors or whatever.
I'm going to start, and I reference this one a couple times in the book, just because it's a story that is really a cultural, I mean, I love it deeply, but it's also a cultural touchstone. Star Wars, the first Star Wars.
Yes.
I mean, God, just so, right? Luke, you know, I remember seeing this as a little kid, and, you know, the lightsabers and all that, and of course, I didn't understand it all as a little kid, but... You know, the story is about a guy who escapes a small world and learns about this, you know, this spiritual force that connects the world, and it can be used for good and evil. And, you know, he's got all these forces working with him and against him. And then that amazing moment at the end where dude turns off the scope, right? He's got one freaking shot to save the day and he turns off the scope and you're like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, what are you doing? And of course, he hits it, and it's just like this lesson of, you know what? Sometimes you just gotta let it go and shoot from your heart. Yeah. So for sure. I love that one.
Yeah, Star Wars.
What's your go-to movie? Like, I could watch this a million times.
It depends on my mood.
Uh-huh.
You know, just a great movie. Of course, another huge one is Pulp Fiction. Just as the dialogue and the story structure of it.
Yes.
Is, you know, when I first saw that, I was like, what?
What is this?
What is going on? Like, it took me several viewings of it, as well as reading like critical analysis of it to understand that this thing is like multiple levels of brilliance.
Mm.
And I wonder how really conscious Tarantino was of everything he was doing. Because that's another thing with creatives, right? There's the conscious part of what you're doing, and there's the skills that you've developed or created or learned or whatever. And that's all great. And you need that to be a high-level artist of any kind. But then the magic comes in underneath in your subconscious, where you make choices as a screenwriter, director, that really maybe don't make sense. You don't understand. You don't even know you're doing it. And then years later, people are looking at Pulp Fiction and being like, this dialogue has multiple levels of meaning astonishing. Did he know he was doing that? I don't know.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think a lot of it's lightning in a bottle sometimes, like in that moment. You know better than anybody, you know, filmmaking being a collaborative art form, there's so many other people contributing. But when you set the vision with the screenplay as the writer and the director, as Tarantino did with Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs and several other of his films, there's something about him that is seeping into that screenplay through the subconscious, like you're saying, that he's not even, that's magical.
It reminds me of The Grateful Dead. So, you know, I was big into the Dead there for a while.
Yeah. Deadheads.
So, deadheads, a bunch of deadheads.
Yeah.
You go to a Dead show, you go to a bunch of Dead shows, and, you know, for people who don't know, The Grateful Dead have all these songs, whatever, but they would jam around in them, just like improvise. And some days, some nights, they would play, and it would just be this cacophony of just like, what the hell?
Noise.
Noise and dissonance. Yeah. Just terrible. And then other nights, it would be music that was so beautiful that you would swear that humans could not conceive of this. They could not possibly create music like this. Where does this come from? It's got to come from the subconscious. All these guys, they knew how to, you know, Jerry knew how to play guitar.
Exactly.
They knew how to play the drums. Like, they were all skilled at what they did. But when they loosened up enough via whatever they were whatever means necessary, they tapped into something that was deep inside them. And,
well,
and also,
like, think about Led Zeppelin too. Right. Like, they're another band that comes to mind when I think about, like, you know, if you lay in the dark and with a good set of headphones and or a good stereo system and you just listen, like, especially now since Jimmy Page has remastered a lot of this stuff, it's even, and you just listen to it, there is a spirit in that music.
Oh, yeah.
And this is like when we talk about, like, music today, you know, we talk about artists today. I mean, think about Jimmy Page as a guitarist. Think about John Bonham as a drummer. Think about Robert Plant. I mean, masters of their craft at the highest level, and magical things happen. You can hear it in the music. I swear. Maybe I'm nuts.
You're not nuts. Millions of people around the world hear that too. They might not say it the same way, but they heard it. So one of the things that I talk about to my songwriting students is sort of what you're touching on there, mastering the guitar. So Jimmy Page can play that freaking guitar. Right? That guy can play the guitar. But if you are completely conscious of what you're doing, you're only part of the way there. Because there's a lot of guys, a lot of women, who can play guitar really well. But what Jimmy Page does and what other really great guitar players and artists does is they learn it, they know it, and then they forget it. And you can see, you know, you look at concert footage from the 70s, dude's eyes closed, like sweat's pouring off him. He's not, that guy's not on earth.
No, he's not. He's not standing there in the stage going, oh, I got another 2 hours to go.
Right. And switch chords here. And yeah, you know, that's not part of it. He's just like, he's tapped in.
Otherworldly almost.
Otherworldly, absolutely. Yeah. And that's where, if you can balance, whether it's a screenwriter or a musician or a poet, anything.
Dialogue for me is like that. Like, almost where you just, like, I hear them in my head, the characters. Yeah. I mean, and this doesn't just happen. You have to know the story and you have to shape out the
You don't hear voices. I'm just clarifying.
I'm just transcribing as quickly as I can. It flows.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, what would you say earlier is two things?
If it doesn't drive the story forward or deepen the character, you don't need it. Get it out.
Yeah, get it out.
Jeff, if folks want to engage with you, they want to buy your book, they want you to come speak, they want to take your webinar classes, how do they find you?
Well, the book is on Amazon and really everywhere. I've got an audiobook too, an ebook. But yeah, the best way is to come to the website, jefflizowitz.com. And I know you know how to spell that. So hopefully, hopefully you guys will have a link there.
Yeah, we
absolutely.
Will.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. We'll have the book too. And we'll put the link to Amazon
on our website.
Right to the website.
And the good news is there's only one Jeff Lizowitz. So if you
not
can
to be
find,
confused with, exactly. with the other Jeff Lizowitz.
Right. So it'll come up on Google if you're anywhere near close.
Okay. Yeah.
What an honor and a pleasure to have
you
on our podcast. You're just an amazing soul, and we've just enjoyed our time with you.
Yeah, this has been an incredible podcast.
Thank you, really. I love it.
Thanks, Jeff. We appreciate it. Save my life, I'm going
down for the last time. Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Woman with the sweet loving better than a white lie. Follow us on Twitter at True North Story. Don't you know she could bring a good feeling, ain't had in such a long time. And tune in next time for another True North Story. Save my life, I'm going down for the last time.